All right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 190. My name's Bob Akairi. It's Tuesday night. This is when we like to talk to you about what's going on in college football, because this is something, just don't want to get a little feedback there. This is just a sport that never sleeps, and we want to make sure we can talk about all the issues that are going on. So as we fire this up, if you'd like to join the conversation or talk about a particular topic, you can always hit request in the bottom left of the Twitter app, the X app, and we'll get to your questions, your thoughts. So lots of things going on. Obviously, the NFL draft is coming up. We've got one of our team that's going to be covering it this week. Covering the draft is a little bit mild. I mean, you're literally sort of in a room listening to what's being said as things go up there. But it's something we thought it would be important to do. We always thought it was a nice close to the college football story for so many of the young men who play and who we enjoy watching. So that's coming up this week. There's been mock drafts going on all over the place. I admit that's not necessarily my strength, but I've been paying attention. It's been interesting to see, particularly this draft cycle. Lots of good wide receivers, but also just seeing the way the quarterbacks, past Caleb Williams, seem to be kind of shuffling back and forth. Will J.J. McCarthy go ahead of Drake May? Where will some of these other guys go? It'll be interesting to see that. I wanted to hit on a couple of other topics, just some fun odds and ends. Number one, and it made the rounds, and I think there was a little confusion from some people who hadn't really seen Jim Harbaugh when he was what he would wear as head coach of Michigan, other than maybe that one old photo of when he was at a practice without a shirt. But Jim Harbaugh finally got a tattoo on his shoulder. Now, you might wonder why that's important. Well, it was kind of an ongoing story for Michigan football. One that I found particularly interesting because as I was preparing for covering the national championship game in Houston this past January, I was tipped off by a couple of Michigan guys that, earlier this season, he had promised the team that if they were to go 15-0, he would get that tattoo on some tattoo, which he had no tattoo. So by chance, I got the last question in the post-game interview immediately after the national championship game, and I asked him about it. And he said, yep, I have never been inked. I'm going to get a tattoo, 15-0, probably above. And it was really funny. He was almost like thinking it out aloud on the stage. But he thought he'd get it on his throwing shoulder. I think what most people were surprised is the M, because he said, I'm going to get the block M, and underneath it'll say 15-0. Really simple. I think a lot of folks were surprised at how simple the M is. Apparently, he's a big fan of this really old Michigan logo. And the reason I say people haven't paid attention to how he would dress during games, he loved wearing a hat with the blue hat with the Maze logo, of this really plain M that doesn't look anything like the logo most of us think of when we think of the Michigan logo. But that's exactly what he got on his shoulder. It's simple. It's all blue, it looks like. When people were complaining about it, I saw the video and I'm like, wow, that's literally what he described at the post-game interview. So Harbaugh got the tattoo he told me about, or told everyone in the room about, and that closes that. I think the probably see less and less of it. I mean, the other critique, and one of the funnier comments I heard that was kind of like, well, what did you expect? The guy is currently living in a trailer park, like on purpose, on an RV on the beach in California as he's coaching the Rams. So I mean, he is living a life he wants and is absolutely loving that moment right now. So one other piece of information I wanted to mention, actually last show, and I totally forgot, and I kind of kicked myself afterwards. Northwestern, for those who haven't been paying attention, Ryan Field has always historically been one of the dingier stadiums in P5. And I know from having sent reporters to cover games, the state of that stadium was rather shocking. The press box was really poor. All of that's amusing only because Northwestern has one of the best journalism programs in the nation, and its sports journalism program has turned out quite a few guys, just like Syracuse, just like Mizzou. To kind of round out some of the three names you always hear in college sports, especially in college football sports. But they're rebuilding Ryan Field, like completely rebuilding it. And it's going to take two seasons to do so. So there was this question of, where are they going to temporarily play? Are they going to play Wrigley Field? Are they going to play Soldier Field? I mean, those are pretty far from Evanston. It's way up north. It's not super far north, but it's certainly further north, and it would be tough for the students. But what they've announced they're going to do is build a temporary structure on basically their lacrosse field. And what's spectacular about this, it's going to be on Lake Michigan. It's going to be like right on Lake Michigan. In fact, if you look up where they're doing this, and you can look up the Northwestern Temporary Football Stadium, you'll see this image of where they're planning to put it. It's right next to that really gorgeous athletics facility they opened before the pandemic that's got like giant glass windows facing Lake Michigan. But somehow they crammed in a couple of fields, which makes sense. They're not like huge sports. There's like a practice football field out there in this lacrosse field. They're going to build apparently temporary bleachers to make this thing. I believe they're aiming for not a huge number of seats. I mean, you just simply couldn't. I don't think they've even put the number down yet, but they reference the Waste Management Open, that game in Arizona, and how they're able to build that enormous temporary stadium around that. We'll see what they do, but this promises to be one of the most interesting college football venues in a long time. I mean, I kind of want to go see a Northwestern game after I heard this is what they're doing, and it's going to be for two seasons now. It could be that if they host a really big opponent, they'll move a game to, if not Soldier Field, maybe, I don't know. They've hosted games at Wrigley Field before. Maybe they'll put it somewhere else. But for a lot of their rank and file games, it looks like this is where they're going to play it. So that's a little different. I mean, obviously, Kansas is the other school that's doing temporary relodging. We've talked about them before. They're going to host their biggest games, at least their Big 12 games, in where the Chiefs play. And they're going to, in Arrowhead, and they're going to have their non-conference games in an MLS stadium on the Kansas City side of the river. But Northwestern straight up, I mean, the parking situation, by the way, is going to probably be horrific for this. I mean, there's a lot of things I can't wait to see. Like, if you want to know how angry that's going to be, I can't wait to see. But it could be a beautiful mess, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how that goes for Northwestern over the next two seasons. But I just wanted to touch on that because it was something. It was really interesting. We never really mentioned last show, so I wanted to throw that out there as well. Kind of jumping around, at D3 level, this was probably not something everyone necessarily follows, but it's fascinating only because for all the discussion of expanding the FBS playoff already, I mean, obviously it's going to be 12 teams for the next two seasons, and then it looks like it may jump to 14 starting in three seasons from now. The D3 playoff, which has obviously always existed, they're about to expand to 40 teams. Apparently, the Division III Management Council approved football's expansion to a 40-team playoff. It goes to the President's Council, but as D3Football.com, who they are, I know the guy who's founded, I've met him before at covering a game, but as he notes, once they receive that Management Council approval, the President's Council doesn't even overrule it. So that means we're going to have 40 teams at D3 in their playoff, which is fascinating. So is that where FBS is going? I don't know. I admit that might be a bit too many, but I just thought I'd throw that out there. And the thing is, it's not like there's a good number of D3 teams, and certainly it's growing, but it's not an enormous number of teams. So I just thought I'd toss that out there. You know, one thing I do want to mention, and I'm going to probably talk about this a little bit more next week. I just today finalized the idea of going and covering a game next weekend. Not this weekend, next weekend. Why would I bother to cover a spring game next weekend? Let me tell you, it's in Ashland, Oregon. So what on earth is in Ashland, Oregon? Southern Oregon University. Why would I go to Southern Oregon University to cover their spring game? Well, it's not a spring game. It's an exhibition. And who's coming to town? The seven-time consecutive national champion of Japan. They somehow, this is like a such an under-the-radar game. This NAIA team in Oregon is hosting the national champion of Japan for an exhibition game. College football in Japan has existed in some form or another since the 1930s. I don't think it's unfortunate, but I oddly know a lot about it. So this team is coming over, and the reason this team is hosting them is because one of these kind of pivotal guys in the development of Japan's college football scene in the 70s and 80s and 90s, for a while he was coaching at Southern Oregon. So a lot of these coaches in Japan would come and like be an assistant on his team in the 80s. Then they'd go back to Japan and kind of, spread the gospel of college football that they'd learned from this guy. And this coach, he'd coached at Wake Forest, he'd coached at Utah State. He'd coached at a lot of, FBS teams. So they call it the Mills Bowl. It's named after Chuck Mills, his head coach. And he only died a few years ago. At the national championship in Japan, they actually did like a moment of silence for him because up until he was like 90 years old, he was showing up in Japan at their title game to hand out the Japanese Heisman, which was named after him. So they're doing the Millis Bowl. It's going to be in two weekends from now. So I'm going to be out in Ashland, Oregon. I figured it would be something interesting to see. Never been to that part of Oregon. Sounds like a fun game. Sounds like something interesting. But let's see here. I see some people want to join us. So I'm going to let Ski Mask Smurfy and Creekwater, and we'll talk to you guys and see what you guys want to talk about. So Ski Mask Smurfy, what's going on? How are you?
I'm doing all right on this fine Tuesday. Well, where I'm at, I don't know how it's going for people other places.
But It's good here.
It's going in Minnesota. Well. Oklahoma, we are doing just fine.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly, I was going to bring this up, and you brought up the Millis Bowl going to play out in Oregon. I don't know why, but for some reason, it made its rounds this week. And someone brought up that they were like the most obscure team that every current Big 12 team has played. And they brought up that in 92, UCF, when I think this would have been when they had just barely moved up to Division I.
Earlier than that. It looks like I'm actually looking them up right now. They were independent. Yeah, you're right. They were FCS. Yeah, they were FCS.
Yeah. They were FCS in 92.
Oh, the Bears. Yes. I heard of this game.
The Commies.
Yes. The thing about it that someone brought up in the post, I don't know if it was RCFB or like someone responded to it, but they brought up in the post that in back-to-back weeks, they played at Western Illinois, then came back home, and the Moscow Bears had showed up, which until the unfortunate war that's going on between Russia and Ukraine was basically a team from basically their top American football league in Russia. And so this team, and the thing about it, it's in the middle of the season. This is their fifth game of the season. They're playing an exhibition game against grown men from Russia. That has to be like one of the most random things ever.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, one thing I will say is it makes sense because it looks like they beat them pretty handily. Every country in the world that's had football, it has gone through this. The United States went through it much earlier, but Canada did this, and Japan recently wrapped this up, where the adult, because the way it happens is college is where it starts. Then everyone wants to kind of either see those college guys play, like or those guys who played college football still want to play as like a team, so they'll form like an adult league of some kind, you know. And then when you get the beginnings of these championships, like, for example, the Grey Cup, which is the CFL championship, was originally kind of open to any team in Canada. So for the first several years, it was the Canadian colleges that were winning it. And then eventually it got so one-sided because the pro teams were just so well organized. With the United States, obviously some of you may know the Chicago All-Star Game, which was a team, the reigning NFL champion would take on a college all-star team. And then eventually by the 70s, it got completely uncompetitive, so they canceled it. In Japan, they had something similar where after the collegiate national championship, they had like a total national championship where the adult champ, which eventually became a pro league, but with the adult team champ would take on the college league champ. And then after
that was
like
the first... Right?
Well, it became known, the X Bowl was the pro championship. They called it the Rice Bowl, like, you know, which is kind of cliche in Japan, right? But the Rice Bowl. So you had the college team playing the pro team. And then after about 7 years, it turned really one-sided. In fact, the last 12 years of it were the pro team winning. And so now they've turned it into just the pro championship, and the college teams finish with their championship game. So it's funny to see that at all these three countries had the exact same kind of approach, where at one point the college teams were dominating, and then the pro teams just got better.
And it's kind of wild that just looking back today, and like 1992 is not that long ago. It's just kind of wild, like that recently, like a college football team played a Russian football team for a game. I will say that the Oklahoma State beat the hell out of the Tulsa businessmen in 1912.
I love it.
I heard you talking about like Japanese football, and the only thing I kind of know about like Asian like football is like the Donnie, like Wonton Don from like Barstool Sports, like, and like before he was really working for them, or maybe he was, but he just started, like, he goes to China a lot and does like a lot of content in China. And one of his series he did is he joined the Chinese football
team. I remember this series. Yeah, I remember exactly what you're talking about.
And I watched all that, and it was kind of fascinating, like, especially when he goes to, like, more rural parts of China and how, like, how it is, but, like, how they are actually interested in the game and how there are, like, a couple of American players, like, ex-D1 college football players, like, on certain teams there. And I was just curious on, like, how big, if you know, like, how popular is American football in, like, China and Japan? Because, like, obviously baseball is huge in Japan and China is, like, all about basketball. But, like, how big is American football in those countries?
You know, before the pandemic, China was getting more and more interested in American football. I remember there are a couple of international competitions that are related. They're not, obviously, it's not an Olympic sport, but the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, recognizes an American Football Federation. And it's always been weird because no one wants the Americans just to stack the team because it would kill the interest in all the other countries if you let an American pro team just kind of go wild on them. But there was one team, and I believe it was there's actually even an international university organization, but again, the NCAA would be an unfair competitor, so they rarely compete. But when China wanted to create a team, they actually hired Ricky Williams, like the Texas running back, you know, Heisman winner, and he coached one of their teams, and they didn't do great, but like they went into the tournament knowing they were going to get slaughtered, basically. But they wanted to like show that they could do it and kind of test, see where they were, quite frankly. I mean, what better way to test than trying out against other teams? Now, Japan's a little unique in that they've been playing it again since the 30s. They've got about 200 college teams. Again, they're not like phenomenal. In fact, gosh, a couple of years ago, I interviewed a couple of guys who were involved in that, just in general reporting, and one guy who was a guy grew up in Hawaii, played for Colorado, had some injuries, so he didn't end up going in the draft, and he ended up playing in the Japanese Pro League as an import player, and he's been there now for like a while. Now he's coaching at one of those schools, and he said, you know, one of the things is a lot of the guys he gets, they're athletic, but they never played it. So they're in college or like picking up football. So it's kind of a different approach to it. And like, there are a couple, the thing is the best teams there, as I've kind of found out, are universities that have like the private universities that have a private high school, and that high school plays football. So they, at least they get some prep. So these teams are kind of farming out, like they have a farm team that kind of that throws up a bunch of players that aren't necessarily like American D1 talent, but you know, at least they know what they're doing.
They know,
so they
kind
of get that practice level, right?
Yeah. And one quick thing, I was born in November of 90, so I don't remember this, but like one thing that's unique is about Japan, at least like back before I was born, was OSU. I don't know if a lot of people did it, I assume they did, but OSU played Texas Tech in like Tokyo in the 80s, and I wonder like why that died out and like why they don't do it. I'm assuming it's
I could tell you that story. I actually know all about that.
Right. Go ahead.
You know, the it's kind of funny that this is sort of coming up, but so what you're talking about is the Coca-Cola Mirage Bowl. It's been called both. In fact, I'm looking up which one. Yeah, there it is. 1988, Oklahoma State, which was ranked number 12, took on Texas Tech. Man, that was a good game. That was 45-42 in the Tokyo Dome. That was when they moved it to the Tokyo Dome. So let me tell you guys what happened. So in 77, they started – actually, let's go back even a little bit earlier. As I mentioned, this coach who was at Southern Oregon, his reason they're playing at Southern Oregon, this Japanese team that's coming in next weekend he was originally at Utah State. So in 71, he did a goodwill tour where they went and played like some exhibition games against like Japanese all-star teams. American team had no trouble handling them. But that was like a big deal. So suddenly that kind of sparked more interest in what was a sport that was, it's always been, you know, behind other sports in Japan. But like it kind of, people in Japan got more into it. And the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Tourism Board for the bicentennial in 76 started really kind of pushing this concept of, hey, check out American football, check out American football. So for those who also maybe are aware of kind of the geopolitics of this, the economy of Japan was extremely strong in the 80s. Like in the 70s and 80s, they called it like the Japanese miracle. It just kind of, they were able to do things. I mean, most people actually told somebody this and they confirmed it by looking up because they didn't believe me. At one point, the land value of the palace in Tokyo, which is a huge palace complex, but not that big when you hear what I'm going to say. The land value is more than the entire state of California. The entire state of California. That's how out of control the economy was going there. And then they hit the brakes around 1991. The economy started to collapse there, and they basically were in a recession for 20 years. Like, they've only recently started to get out of it. Like, 2018 is when they started to climb out of it. But during that peak, they were able to throw money at some crazy ideas. So in 77, they started this concept of let's pay for two American football teams to come and play a regular season game in Japan. So it was usually the end of the regular season. So they called it a bowl game, but it wasn't really a traditional bowl game. It was always a regular season game. They'd plan it a year in advance to give the team's time, the fans' time, you know, all the organization, passports, all that stuff. But so a lot of random American teams played one game in Japan. And for example, like my alma mater, USC, played in 85. It was just the end of the regular season game against second to the last game against Oregon. And then they came back and played UCLA. I mean, the most attended game was 82 when Clemson and Wake Forest played a good game there. So, I mean, they had all kinds of random teams played these games in Japan, and they were one-offs, and it was to promote that. But then it ends in 93 because it took about 2 years for the money to just – they realized they weren't going to kind of economically bounce back. So the money kind of dried up, so 93 was the last of those games. So that's why they all dried up, all the Japanese kind of – crossovers dried up in that era because the money to sponsor them just wasn't there anymore.
That's interesting. I'm glad that, you know, I didn't know the reason. I just thought it was kind of random, so I'm glad I know why. And one quick comment, and then I know that Ski wants to say something, but do you think that the NFL or just American football in general is, like, banking on the Olympics to get, like, people in the flag or football just by starting with a flag, kind of like how the Dream Team got the whole world into basketball, is like dip their toe in with flag and then get them slowly over, you know, the course of, you know, some years to like just full on.
I think, yeah, the flag football thing is definitely the way they're using to attract more people around the world. And I mean, this international game stuff is great. I mean, obviously the NFL is playing at Sao Paulo next season. I have a Packers friend who's going down there for that game. You know, like, so they're trying to grow it a lot more. I mean, Mexico has been basically successfully, you know, sold on that. If you've ever been to Mexico, if you ever talked to folks there, they are absolute enormous NFL fans there. I mean, obviously soccer's huge, obviously probably still number one. I'm not going to pretend anything else, but there is some real serious love for the NFL and college football in Mexico. I mean, they've got their own decent teams out there too. Ski Mask, what's going on?
Oh, I was just going to build off all your comments. I was going to say, this week, also the name card for Fridge Perry, because you brought up the Clemson game. That name card sort of made its rounds too after people brought up the whole Moscow situation with UCF. They did bring up the Mirage Bowl and showed like the Fridge's name card was like really big, because I'm looking at like all of the games, and like half of these games, the teams going into their last game of the season were playing in Tokyo, but also were like in competition that they could possibly win this game and end up in a major bowl game, which is also interesting. But I was going to bring up that even not with Japan, but Europe, they've sort of rebranded what used to be NFL Europe and have sort of built a like half pro, like half sort of college level league. Because over there with their sports, they didn't really see the concept of going to college before going pro. And they sort of like took off a good amount of teams, like the old NFL Europe teams, and just took their names. And like a lot of players are going over there and playing. I know the infamous Michael Sam is one of the coaches for the Barcelona Dragons. And so guys over there playing over there. I think a few years ago, like one guy did get drafted out of that league to the Vikings. I don't think he ended up making the team long term, but the NFL also has that the international transfer program a little bit where like they try to make sure like each team has one slot dedicated to a guy who did not play American college football who can come from overseas and play.
A lot of Australian like rugby guys and stuff. And not punters. Yeah. They want like a lot of them are return men type players. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was agreeing with you. I was going to say the punter situation is different than the rest. The punters, a lot of them come from Australia. They come from Aussie Rules Football. And, like, they actually have, like, a whole, like, development center, like, based around guys who play Aussie Rules Football. They say, would you like to go to college in America? Then they have, like, a whole, like, little youth academy just for those guys for the punting situation.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of parents in America that have kids that are, like, really good high school punters and kickers are starting to get frustrated because colleges are starting to overlook the 18-year-old American kid for, like, a 26-year-old Aussie kid. And they're saying that they're taking, like, American kid scholarships. Yeah, man. Yeah,
this is sort of the thing we were talking about the other week with Calipari. With his coaching thing. Yeah, that's what they've been doing with the punters a little bit. I mean, the situation was already bad that basically only 1 in 5 kickers and punters actually have a scholarship normally. But, yeah, the Aussie guys are taking away because I think
– And I get it. If that's you as an 18-year-old, if that's your kid, I get being frustrated. But, you know, like now that the pay-for-play things, it's like now it's a profession and, like, they're going to take the best guy. You know, they can take a 26-year-old man over an 18-year-old kid. They're going to. But I do get the frustration that the American, like, parents and the kids that are, like, 18 have with it. But that's just the way it is now. I don't know if it's ever going to change, honestly.
It's fascinating. It's really fascinating stuff. Hey, Magic Ingram. I'm always Magic. What's going on, man? How are you?
Oh, it's okay. That got me laughing. Oh, my goodness. How are you doing tonight?
Good. What's on your mind?
Oh, I'm surprised I ain't even no one talk about it. NFL draft coming up.
Yeah,
this
we
Thursday.
Haven't really talked about it that much yet. Obviously, it's coming up. We've got we'll have somebody covering it for our CFB on our Twitter account. He's going to be in Detroit. But yeah, it's an interesting draft. It'll be curious to see. It's interesting to see like the mock drafts going on. I mean, obviously, I think Caleb Williams number one is basically a foregone conclusion. But then kind of see where the other quarterbacks, you know, is Jaden Daniels next? I think probably. But then you got Drake May, J.J. McCarthy, who's going to go after that. There's some great wide receivers. I've heard Malik Nabers is climbing up. So, I kind of still expect Marvin Harrison to go above him. But, you know, Malik Nabers, there was a really good article, and Bruce Feldman's really good at this. I mean, he wrote for The Athletic where he interviews like a bunch of, like not only pros, but college, you know, coaches anonymously to kind of get a read on who impressed them the most. And it's fascinating to sometimes see where some of the guys get placed versus, you know, because that's always a hard thing, right? You know, what we think of as college fans versus what they see and what they're looking for in the pros. And some are obvious, like Joe Alt, probably the best offensive lineman out there. Dallas Turner was just ferocious. And I think a lot of fans in the SEC are glad he's not going to be lining up for the Crimson Tide next season. But yeah, it's fascinating stuff. What are your thoughts on the draft?
I just hope it's going to be good. Like, I wonder if some of the Michigan boys are going to be coming back with Jim Harbaugh with the Chargers.
I think the Chargers are going to get Marvin Harrison Jr., and I think that is a steal for them. One of the most interesting, at least to me, draft prospects is J.J. McCarthy, because it seems like hardcore college football fans all universally, like most of them anyway, do not think he's an NFL guy, but the NFL GMs and the scouts all think he does. I don't know if I've ever seen like such a split on like people that are hardcore college football fans and like the scouts as I have with McCarthy, and it's going to be interesting to see how his career turns out. Like, really,
I agree with you so much. Because yeah, then you're also hearing like they're also watching Drake May and everyone. I keep reading footwork needs work. And I'm just kind of like, okay. It's fascinating. So, hey, Ski Mask, I know your hand's up and I know you got thoughts on this one because obviously, Michigan guy.
I was going to get into the JJ McCarthy point that Creek brought up. It is weird. It is so weird because most of the diehard college football fans look at JJ McCarthy and it's like, yeah, we see him as a nice fifth, sixth, you know, a third day pick to put on your team and be like, hey, we might have a decent backup we can develop when we already got a starter. But then all the former scouts, the hidden GMs who are talking to reporters, is like, everyone's like, no, we're going to trade up. Someone's going to trade up to get McCarthy. I'm just sitting there like, what? I mean, and everyone's looking at Brock Purdy. He's like, yeah, look at Brock Purdy. you send a guy around some weapons he can play. It's like, yeah, but it's like Brock Purdy was the last pick. People were honest with Purdy. This is like, I don't know. It's the weirdest thing I've seen in terms of quarterbacks. So,
and it's funny too. You'll read what people say, and they're like, you know, he can make some plays. He has talent. I think he won some people over with his interviews, and I've heard Drake May did that as well. But at the same time, they're like, yeah, but he also can he throw more than one type of throw? And you're just kind of like, yeah, that is important if you're a quarterback. Like, can you not just fire off a rocket? Can you do the other balls? Can you put some air under it? Can you, you know, I mean, there's at least three good throws you got to be able to do, and. Yeah, they haven't really seen it, but something they're seeing. They're just seeing some, and you know, that's why they're. Well, I mean, it's not like the NFL hasn't made mistakes before, but I mean, I just like, man, this is where I'm out of my depth.
And McCarthy, as an OSU fan, so maybe this is why I can draw this comparison. McCarthy reminds me of Mason Rudolph. Mason Rudolph had a lot of talent. He didn't have like the O line that Michigan provided. Actually, OSU's line was kind of their weakness at those times, and Mason Rudolph played a great last three, but like people are evaluating him like a top four pick, which he could be, but like that's, if I had to comp him, that's what I'd comp him to, because I feel like they're very similar guys.
You that's a pretty good comparison with no shade to either player, but it's just normally it's like the Zach Wilson thing where it's like a pro day or like combine. You see it move up the charts, see that trajectory. Like, there's always a few guys that happen to it, it just goes up, especially a wide receiver who runs a good 40. But this is sort of like, as soon as the season was over, it was like, yeah, JJ top 10. I was like, who are these people? What do they know that we don't know?
So, but Michigan, it's the NFL draft. So Michigan fan, because I didn't know you're a Michigan fan until they just mentioned it. So, Michigan fan.
Michigan, Brad, yeah.
They don't,
we're all,
they don't feel like McCarthy.
We're puzzled.
Yeah, y'all don't feel like McCarthy is
like
the top four or five pick?
I feel like he is.
If he was in a draft that was not this draft, possibly. But you got Caleb, Drake May, Jaden Daniels. This is just – this one and –
we're not giving any good people in the same draft.
Penix.
Michael Penix. Yeah, Penix, Bo Nix is like – it's. He was looking at his draft class, and it's like, yeah, this is the draft class where you say to a guy, yeah, you should have stayed your extra year. But, yeah, if it wasn't this draft class, I would say, yeah, you could take him as a high quarterback. But this is just
– yeah, it's a big
– it's weird.
It's a big draft, but, like, he just – his stock won't ever get no higher. Like, he just won a national championship, let a team undefeated.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, you got to go at that point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like I said, I'm Oklahoma State guy. I have season tickets, and I go to every Bedlam, and that's over with, and it sucks for everybody. But I got to watch OU have, like, four straight years, like, of the Bedlam games. I got to watch Baker, Kyler, Jalen, and Caleb Williams. And the only one we beat was Caleb Williams. But watching an 18-year-old Caleb Williams in person – that man was better than Kyler Murray. He was better than Jalen Hurts. He was better. He was frustratingly good. And OSU actually had a really good defense that year. That's why we won games in 21. And just, like, it's not like he would, like, Michael Vick and outrun everybody. It's just like he's slippery. Like, he's oily. Like, people can't get their hands on him. And, like, I think he's going to be a star. And I'm not a Caleb Williams guy, and now, but I think he's getting a lot of, like, to over-hated on the internet now, but I think, like, he is the clear number one overall pick in this draft, and I think he's going to be a Pro Bowler for sure. I'm not going to go out and say he's a Hall of Famer, but, like, he is going to be a quarterback, starting quarterback in the NFL for the next 10 to 15 years, in my opinion, wow. No doubt.
That is great. But he also has the funniest comp I've ever heard about a quarterback, because, as you said, he's been getting some weird hate lately. And what is his name? Pablo Torre on his show. He had one of the guys who got a quote from a current NFL GM or executive. And the guy said, yeah, Caleb Williams, the negatives we have about him is that the kid's just weird. It's like if Prince played football. That is the funniest comp I've ever heard of a player.
Oh man, I hope he says. I hope he, if he ever, if he wins an NFL game, if he's starting, I assume he gets to play and wins an NFL game. You know, I hope he just goes to the mic and just looks and just says game blouses.
Exactly.
Game Bears.
I just said if he hears this, this can only lead to Jameis Winston level of antics when he wins a game.
Yeah. Jameis Winston.
Oh my goodness.
Babyface though, like he got a lot of hate on the internet. And now, like, over the course of the past year or two, like, he's really become, like, beloved on the internet now. Like, his quirkiness was hated on, and now it's beloved. And I don't know, like, Jalen or Caleb Williams is, I don't know, he's a character, and, like, maybe he was just young. But, like, the stuff he, like, he acted a lot different as the Southern Cal quarterback than he did as the OU quarterback. And I hate I hate OU. Like, I'm not a fan. But, like, like, a lot – maybe he was just older. But he's a lot more, like, look at me. A lot more, like, I'm trying to, like, be noticed. And maybe that's just the L.A. thing. But he was, like, way different seeming to me as the Oklahoma quarterback than the USC quarterback.
No, I think people – yeah, I agree. And maybe to some extent it's just the people he built around him to kind of market him out. Yeah, I want to hit up a couple of other just real quick news and notes before I forget, just in case maybe some people want to mention these. I think, I can't remember if we talked about it enough last week, but I still think so far after yet another week of spring games, Ole Miss won the spring game world with those Grove Bowl games, which had nothing to do with football, other than I think they had like a 7-on-7, you know, not pads, you know, kind of game. They had a tug of war. With football players, they had a slam dunk competition. Football players, I think even the sororities got into the tug of war contest. They let 21 and over fans go behind one of the end zones with their own alcohol. They obviously had Joey Chestnut there for hot dog eating contest with the football players. I mean, that was ridiculous. It was hilarious. It was a great way to make sure the other teams don't get film on your players for the transfer portal. But my goodness, I kind of hope we see more of that because most of these games are pretty dull. And don't tell us a whole lot. I mean, I know Phil Steele was angry because he actually watches spring games to try and figure out who's like the three deep when he's putting those together. But I think for fans, I mean, that would be amazingly fun.
I'm with you. As a, like, Oklahoma State never does a spring game. Like, Mike Gundy hates them. Like they'll, like, run out stuff of OSU spring game is like, we're going to watch 7-on-7. We're going to watch – it's almost like watching them team warm up before a real game. That's like the equivalent of what Oklahoma State does every single year. And I think that if they did something like that, because, like, it's not like a national thing, but, like, OSU, the fan base, like, is always, like, bitching about how we don't do anything. And the fact that Ole Miss didn't do anything either but made it fun, I think OSU should really learn from that.
Yeah, Oklahoma State could have real fun with that. Could you imagine what Gundy's, like, things that – I don't know if Gundy would necessarily come up with fun ideas, but – yeah, that would be interesting because, I mean, Kiffin was straight up dropping in Joey Chestnut's DMs. Like, that's how they got him. Like, I don't know. That doesn't quite strike me as a man who's now well above 50 would do it. But
he did have that Justin Bieber ringtone that one time because Bieber had him as his ringtone. Like, Gundy, like, I just watching OSU, like, my whole life, like, you can tell, like, Oklahoma State, if they're going to have a good team, like, or if Mike Gundy thinks they're going to have a good team in the spring and then fall camp. Like, if he's, like, joking around and, like, he's, like, you know, national media talks about, you know, like, his Gundy self with his mullet and cracking jokes and stuff, we're going to be good. And then, like, if Mike Gundy gets quiet and it's, like, you know, does the Bill Belichick way with reporters, it's like we might go 7-5. Like you can really read it. Like, I'm not even joking. Like,
that's funny. Yeah. Ski Mask, I see your hand up.
Yeah. Now that we're talking about spring games, did you know about the Miami situation? They only had 1,000 fans at their spring game.
That sounds about right, though. I mean, it's some of these programs. I mean, Miami, I mean, for a regular season game against an opponent with a pulse has trouble pulling in fans. So I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. It's hard in some of these warm weather places. I haven't seen like USC and UCLA probably don't even pull in that many. I mean, there were some somewhat deceptive photos of what was going on at Washington last year before their season. But, you know, they still don't bring in a ton of guys. I mean, it's just hard, especially in the coastal cities. It's just never been quite as big And I'm talking like cities, like to kind of get people to go in for that, which is a shame. I mean, there was a lot of hype at USC before that 2005 season, because then that's when you had, you know, Reggie Bush, Matt Leiter.
They've won two.
But even then, they didn't like sell out the Coliseum.
Yeah, and the way I would describe Miami is they have maybe the most casual fans in the country, but they might have the least hardcore fans in the country. Like they are a brand. So if like the Lakers or something, like if Miami's good, they're gonna have so many fans. But it's like people are just casual. So if they're not good, they don't care. But when they're good,
where did they hold the game?
I wouldn't say that. It was on campus. I know it was in their facility. I don't.
Okay, that's
like
smart, because putting that all the way in Hard Rock would have been a waste.
Yeah, just for me, it's just knowing the culture of that Miami team. Having seen the Orange Bowl in person, it's like they used to be like a team that had a hardcore famous, and now they've like faded away.
If they're good, yeah. If they're just good,
sad.
They'll be back as soon as they're like top five in the country. They will all be back.
No, they're in a city where people will jump on board, for certain. I think that, and if they get really good, people are going to start to remember why people got annoyed with Miami.
Do you think that they should build a stadium on campus? Because Troy Aikman was talking about this like before last football season started about UCLA. He had went on like a podcast or something and said that.
I heard that, but that was crazy because I know UCLA's campus, there's only one spot it might fit, and it would be so hard to do because the amount people who haven't been to UCLA. UCLA is sandwiched between of an expensive part of Westwood and a crazy rich part of Brentwood, like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Like Bel-Air is just north of UCLA. So the amount and that would be the side where they would access the stadium. All right. So to try and imagine the NIMBY group that would fight them, like you'd be fighting people with billions of dollars in their pocket who just don't want the stadium next door. Yeah. So I remember hearing that, and I'm like, yeah, no, you have a better chance of somehow getting SoFi as your stadium than they are. Because UCLA's never played football games on their campus, at least major games, because their first home stadium was the LA Coliseum, and it was the LA Coliseum until 1982, 84, I always forget which one. And then when they decided to move out, let USC keep it for just themselves, and they moved to the Rose Bowl, which was, of course, much farther away from campus. Miami's tricky, though, because I remember when they were talking about that concept, if you actually look at their campus in Coral Gables, because first of all, people don't realize it's a much smaller university than I think people realize. Just student population and just campus size, it is really hard to figure out a way to fit a camp stadium. There is one or two spots where you'd have to demolish a few buildings, and you might be able to fit one in, but they are jammed back there because again the Orange Bowl wasn't on campus. It was a little bit further away, not as far as Hard Rock.
The way Troy Aikman, like his envision, I get that, like, you're battling billionaires, so you're kind of screwed, but there'd be a lot of rich people battling for it too. He said he wants a 35,000 seat stadium, which is small. Like that's like a that's half.
Well, and they've got a stadium. If you ever look at the USC campus, you can see exactly where he wants to put it because they had at one point in the 60s, 50s, they actually had a sketch of one that they could have built, but they didn't do it. But their track stadium, I forgot the name of it, right in the middle of that camp, because the camp is sort of vaguely shaped like a Y, and right at the kind of the pocket that the Y forms, there is a track stadium there because there's two hills that kind of make up this campus. And that's where they would put it. And the problem is the only way to access it is Sunset Boulevard, which, again, having lived in LA, that it would be the traffic snarl, even if the neighbors said go for it, would be so bad. I can't, like, it makes me want to cry just trying to think what it would be like to have 35,000 people try to go to that stadium, even from multiple angles. Oh my gosh. Like,
yeah. I
don't even live there and I would want to fight that stadium. Like, that. I went to USC and I would theoretically would think I would want them to suffer. And I'm like, no, that's just cruel. I believe in the Geneva Convention.
I did go to a game once at the Rose Bowl. Like growing up, like my whole family's OU, except for me. I don't know. Maybe I don't know why, but I just don't remember the side, and I've just always been OSU. And that was back when OU was like dominant in the early 2000s. I was like 10, 12. And I never switched. And OU would go to like, and I would hear about the history. OU would go to a lot of Orange Bowls. And then they went to the Rose Bowl, like, against Washington State. And I always wanted OSU to go to one of those games. Like, we've been to the Sugar Bowl. We've been to the Fiesta Bowl a number of times. Cotton Bowl, but, like, we've never really been at the Orange Bowl or the Rose Bowl. So when we played UCLA in L.A. in, like, 2004, my grandpa took me to that game. And I got to watch OSU play UCLA at the Rose Bowl. And that – the crowd, it wasn't like a, you know, like the Rose Bowl, but like it was like 67. It was a good crowd for the mm-hmm. second game of the year, whatever that was, and we won. And I thought that was like the coolest thing to like watch my team play at that stadium. And
yeah, it's a beautiful stadium. And yeah, I completely agree. And Oklahoma, by the way, in that, I remember that year, that was the 2002 season, 2003 Rose Bowl, yeah. Because that was a year where in the BCS system, and the Rose Bowl has always been the nightmare to deal with every time they've tried to create a postseason series, like the BCS and then the college football playoff. But they basically always wanted the top Pac-12, top Big Ten team in those days before the Pac-12. That year, I believe it was Ohio. Yeah, that was Ohio State year where they went and won in double overtime. Miami. So that spot freed up, and they were expecting to get. They had to take Wazoo because they had beat USC, and USC was the at-large team, and so they were hoping to get Iowa because Iowa was also good. That was when Iowa had the Heisman runner-up with Brad Banks, and then. Out of nowhere, the Orange Bowl, I love it. Their lawyers read the contract. Apparently, once every, I don't know, 4 years, it was some of the huge thing. It was like once every 4 to 6 years, each of the BCS bowls could pull rank and just in one game say, no, we're gonna play this Uno reversal card, whatever. We're gonna jump ahead. And they not only picked, they already had to get USC because USC had only, that was the only place USC could go. They picked Iowa. So the Rose Bowl was furious. So the Orange Bowl gets USC-Iowa. And not only do they get USC-Iowa, it's the only time, I mean, now there's been other times, but it was the first time ever that the Heisman winner, Carson Palmer, and the Heisman runner-up played against each other after that Heisman ceremony. But then Wazoo didn't really show up. They couldn't sell all of their allotment to the Rose Bowl. Oklahoma did, because you know that's their like. How often does a Big 10 team in those days get to do it? So Oklahoma bought up all of their spots, but Wazoo didn't quite. And the Rose Bowl was furious. They were so angry after that. I'm glad he brought that one.
So they picked the Orange Bowl. A couple things. It's wild to me that Washington State did not sell out their Rose Bowl allotment when they like don't ever make it. And that might be why they're in the Mountain West now or whatever. But the Orange Bowl picked Iowa over Oklahoma. Like, I think the Rose Bowl came out on top having and I hate OU, like I said, but like having Oklahoma is a bigger deal than having Iowa.
You know what? That year though, Iowa was a really hot commodity and they knew that match with USC was going to be a bigger sell. And I think that was the thing. And Oklahoma obviously really wanted to go to the Rose Bowl. They actually were thrilled with the idea. So it's kind of a thing where those two groups actually were both on the same page. But the Rose Bowl absolutely was not, and was just furious that all of this had happened. So I don't know. That was just one of those kind of amusing, one of those amusing moments that might have got lost in history. But I still remember how furious they were. That kept coming up for years afterwards. Ski Mask, I know you wanted to add something.
Wasn't this like around the time I think like the Rose Bowl sort of like forced the BCS to like change up their whole system of how they put the team together? Because I remember it used to just be
That was actually pressure from the G5 and the Senators. Like Utah's Senators were both really strong on pushing for more access. So that was actually more to resolve the fact that they were starting to get risk of legislation against them. So they added the fifth game, which you're talking about. Because, yeah, you're right. It was rotating between the four bowls. And then they added the fifth game as a separate one, which was doubling up on one of the four locations. But, yeah, it pleased the Rose Bowl because then the Rose Bowl got to keep that situation, you know. And one year people were mad at them only because that was the 2007 season where, you know, shit we had two out. Teams.
Wild shit happened that
year. Well, it was USC and Georgia – you know, if you know how that season ended, they finished the season ranked number two and number three, alternating in the two polls. And their opponents were weak. The Sugar Bowl had Georgia versus the undefeated Hawaii team. And the real reach that the Rose Bowl did is they paired USC against a relatively low-ranked Illinois team because they wanted to preserve the traditional matchup. And they were, yeah, it was two very unmatched games. And then, you know, we didn't really resolve much from it.
I think Rutgers was, like, really good. That was the Ray Rice Rutgers team that year. That was, like, number two.
Yeah, that was the wild year. Yeah. I remember that year so well. That was just a nutty year.
Wait, 07, that's the BCS mess, right?
We all remember how that opened for Michigan that year. I'm just gonna say that. You know?
It's all right. I mean, that's sort of a mixed bag for me because I graduated from Michigan in 2017, but my dad attended Appalachian State. So
yeah, and you won a national title, so just be happy. I'm over here fighting for cotton bowls, but.
You know, I want to bring up one other kind of little funky story just before I forget, only because we've been talking about what every time obviously we live in Oklahoma, but I've been thinking about and I know this is in Texas, but the Rio Grande. Only reason I bring it up is I don't know if you all heard this. There's a new college football team that is going to be, I believe, an NAIA. And I love it because it's not pronounced the way everyone else in the everyone's shocked this school even exists, which is unfortunately, and no disrespect, is a trend in NAIA when you hear about the school names. But it's the University of Rio Grande, but it's spelled like what most people say, Rio Grande. It's a small college in the kind of almost I don't know if they call it the Appalachian side, but basically the kind of the mountainous side in the southeast port of Ohio. They're going to be bringing back football. I didn't know they ever had it, but they're going to be bringing football back in 2025. The funny thing is, there's another team that also is called Rio Grande, and it's the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. They're adding football in 2025 as well. They're going to be FCS. They're going to be in the WAC, but Rio Grande is going to be. And what I did learn, I looked it up because I'm like, I've never heard of this place. Where's Rio Grande, Ohio? Apparently, this is where the original Bob Evans is, like Bob Evans Farm, the restaurant chain, for some of you who are familiar with it. That is where they were founded. So, like, this stadium that they're going to be playing is going to be, like, the closest thing to the original Bob Evans. So, in fact, some people have called it Bob Evans University. So, there you go, for those of you who are into that particular restaurant. One other thing I also wanted to note, Florida State is getting a little bit of heat for this. Their rings came in, and they say 13-0. Of course, they had a 14th game, which is not noted in this. You know, I get it. You make your rings however you want them, but, you know, a little bit of heat on those. And it's funny. We haven't even talked about the portal because I just have to make one portal comment because this was hilarious. Because last week we kind of talked about, I don't know if you had a chance to talk about Deion Haynes, you know, star defensive end at Pitt. He leaves Pitt, and he was getting the biggest NIL contract by all accounts. And then as he leaves, he says something that you're sure some of the players think, but no one ever says it. But he literally said to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter, like, I want to go play somewhere. I mean, like, we're building something here, but I want to go play somewhere that's going to win. I mean, that's what he said on his way out the door of Pitt. But then where does he go? He's committed to Colorado. And again, no. Colorado's just such a mystery world right now that no one's even sure what's going to happen this season. Maybe they're going to, like, I always thought, okay, if Colorado's going to show improvement, they'll go to a bowl game. Like, that would be an improvement. But to say what you said, that he wants to go because he wants to go to a place that can, quote, win now, and then to go to Colorado where everyone's like, wow, I wonder what's happening there.
Deion Sanders has turned full heel. Like he was always like kind of cocky to where it turned like half the people off or like a third of the people like didn't like him. But like the fact that like they put out like if you want to come here, talk to Shador or whatever, like that's wild to me.
I don't know if he said that. Because that was like his kid said that. Like Shiloh's the one who put that on like Instagram. Yeah, reach out to me in all caps if you're a defensive player and reach out to, you know, I'm summarizing, to Shador if you're an offensive player. But then he adds that weird line at the end, you know, like, we're not last chance you. This is not last chance
disclaimer.
You.
Man, that is so strange. I can't believe his dad suggested that. Like that would that almost seems like too wild.
I think that the guy put it on the internet without asking his dad, and then you can't
exactly
even if you delete it. Like, cause you're, if Deion told him to delete it, like the screenshots will still be there, and so like it'll still be a big story. So they're kind of just, you know, they're in it after he said it. But it's such a fascinating ordeal. Like Colorado, like they had such a hot start last year, and everyone was like, "See, told you." And then they went 1-8 in conference, and now they're coming into the Big 12, and. And the one thing about – I know I keep bringing up Oklahoma State, but I'm just a hardcore mark. But the one thing about OSU is they always get – their over-unders are always, like, so bad. Like, if you bet the over in Vegas on Oklahoma State's wins, I think you would have won, like, 90 or 85% of the time over the past decade. Like, and we have 21 starters coming back, and we have a 7.5 over-under. And Colorado has, like, more than us. And it's just a fascinating – thing. Like I think that prime is because the Big 12 has a lot of hardcore fans, and but they're just not, you know, they're no Bama or Georgia, there's no Texas or OU now, but there's still a ton of fans of Big 12 teams, and Deion does bring eyeballs, and so I hope that they do good. I do, but they're just, it's super fascinating just to watch this.
Like at this point, they're so unprecedented, it's impossible to guess. It's impossible to guess because no one's done anything like this to build a football team.
And like, no coach, no college D1 coach, like, talks about, like, a 19 or 20-year-old leaving, like, Deion. Like, when they ask him about it, he was like, you know, we lost some players, and they go, well, what did we really lose?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, one of the players goes, depth. Which I was like, yes, you lost depth, Deion. But I was just so proud of whoever reporter said depth. But, like, it's just wild. Like, I could not imagine, because Mike Gundy saying that or Bob Stoops saying that. Like, they would not even comment on it. But the fact that, like, outward, it's almost attention-seeking. It's what it has to be.
Yeah. Wild. It's interesting to see who's going out because now they're starting to hemorrhage players again, which kind of makes sense. I mean, it was expected with what he was saying, but the Cormani McClain thing is interesting because obviously he was a cornerback that they flipped from Miami, you know, 5-star, and then during the season, some of you may remember they like Deion straight up called him out for his play, and he struggled a bit. So now the thing is though, like you read what he's the teams two of the teams that are apparently battling for him are USC and USF, and I'm like, wait, what? Like, when did South Florida and University of Southern California start being peers competing
with this
guy? Like,
OU.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, wait,
what? how's USF in that battle?
Yeah, I know. I'm like, well, he's from Florida, maybe that's it, but like, hot dang, how? Like, I mean, and then obviously the other name, there's so many interesting names in the portal now, and we're going to see maybe a few more. As some folks have in the know pointed out, some of the biggest names we probably won't hear about until they basically leave at the last second, appear at the other team, and you find out they've probably been talking the whole time. But one of the names that obviously people kind of remember is Jaden Rashada. He's back in the portal, Arizona State. We all remember, for those of us who are really into this stuff, that wild ride with Florida. Being promised $13 million, although it sounds like it was at least he didn't get any of it, but it also sounds like part of the problem was the guy he hired to help him was a guy either in college or out of college who was holding himself out as like an agent for NIL, which is why you hire pros, for the record. If there's that amount of money, pay a real lawyer or agent or somebody really expert to do it because he walked away with nothing there except going to Arizona State where obviously he had to step up because of an injury and then he got injured. But it's the wild thing is apparently George is looking at him kind of someone to put behind Carson Beck, which isn't bad. It ain't a bad thing to go. Hey, Mage Ingrid, I see your hand up. You've been up here and I feel bad. We haven't really heard from you as much. So what's on your mind?
So question. So I saw the highlights of the Michigan spring game, and so I'm like, okay, who's going to be quarterback? Because Alex Orchard was actually really good, as far as I saw. To me, saying it's going to be a good old battle. Who's going to be quarterback?
And one quick thing about Michigan, and I mad respect. I'm still butthurt that y'all got Dax Hill. Dax and Justice Hill grew up Oklahoma State guys. Justice went to OSU. And, like, we OSU fans were so sure that we were going to get Dax Hill. And then he went to Michigan. I know it's a sidebar, but I'm still, like, sour about that.
Well, Ski Mask, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, but I've heard Alex Orji really did kind of – I've heard a few different voices who I respect say, like, it seems like he may have walked up the position, at least more so than I think people expected, because I went into this spring game thinking that there might be a chance that Michigan then suddenly dips into the portal, but it sounds like Alex kind of works.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for all Michigan fans, but, yeah, a lot of them after the spring game were – are really set on him. I was already set on him last season from watching when he did get into the game. I just saw it as, okay, Sherrone Moore coaches a very good O-line. Harbaugh's is going to develop him. He just has natural feet for athletic talent. I was like, there's no reason for me to watch the spring game because he's going to do well, in which I ended up watching the one kid I hate actually play good, watching the Texas spring game with Arch Manning. He played really well, so I got to eat some of my words that I said earlier this season. But, yeah, he pretty much has a spot locked up. People thought we would go into the portal. But I think it's better, from what we've seen, we're better just to stick with him because the portal is pure madness. Because I originally had my hand raised because I wanted to talk about, you know, the portal's been a free-for-all in all sports, and I wanted to bring up the Oregon State women's basketball situation, where because the whole Pac-12 dissolving, this is a team that just made the Elite Eight and played a really good game against the eventual champions, and they've lost basically the whole team because they got paired with the West Coast Conference, I believe, which is like Gonzaga and Pepperdine. And so, like, all the girls have just left. Like 80% of the points that were scored last season are gone. And all of these girls transferred, aren't grad transfers, just got like, most of them have like 2 to 3 years left to play basketball.
That's wild, but
that's crazy.
I don't think I think that it just sounds crazy because Oregon State is associated with the Pac-12. If you go look at like a Tulsa or a North Texas or any school at that level in the G5, they lose all their best. Like if they have a guy that's an NFL prospect or an NBA prospect, they will lose them every time.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the drawbacks of the portal now is that the really good players in all sports are just going to go to like the blue blood programs.
Or people right. Going to play. Like Indiana State went to the NIT championship and they should have had all five starters coming back off a team that just went and got second in NIT. So they should be ready to make a run next year. All five left.
Yeah, because Kareem Abdul-Jabbar followed the coach. So that's a very big issue.
It's just kind of fat. Like, I'm for people getting paid, and I'm for the transfer portal. But like, I do think there should be some guidelines on it. And I think that everyone should get. And this is just my uneducated opinion, but I think that everyone should get one free transfer. But I don't think you should be able to do it without the second time without sitting out a year.
Well, unfortunately, that's completely that cat seems to be for now out of the bag, only because that lawsuit that was filed by. Tennessee and Virginia. Now the NCAA has codified it. It's going to be as long as you're in good academic standing at your old school and you will be working towards a degree at your new school, you can transfer as many times as you want. That's the new official NCAA rule. Thanks to the previous lawsuit. I will say this: we do pay attention to the very top players and the top programs, but the backfilling that then occurs at the other programs has been kind of fascinating because then you see. Players move from everywhere. You see players, obviously a good number of players from P5 that are looking for playing time, willing to look at the G5. You get, you know, players from FCS D2 that are moving around. So sometimes you get an interesting, obviously it's not quite the same. It does seem disheartening when you lose some of these superstars, but there is some movement that can strengthen these teams. And it can be interesting. I think one thing that is also notable, and I know, I believe, was The Athletic or somewhere created. Oh, yeah, it was an NFL. They graphed what the NFL was seeing with underclassmen entries in the NFL draft. And for folks who haven't seen it, it has been dropping each year. I mean, 2015, it peaked around 2019, where well over 100 and 120 or so people entered the draft who were underclassmen, and now we're dropping down to less than half of that. So
maybe
it's
maybe they're just not, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off, but maybe they're just not developing because they keep bouncing around. Like,
well, we are dealing with that. No, we are dealing with the tail end of the COVID kids, because that added a real weird hiccup to eligibility. So we've got a lot of older players than we had before. But even then, think about it. So many of these players who might have been willing to jump in to try and get that NFL payday, which wasn't always guaranteed, but take that risk, you can get a little bit of a safer bet by just sticking around for, you know, may not be an enormous sum, but I mean, it's a little more guaranteed money in a lot of ways. You know, I want to mention. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was going to say it's sort of like the transfer portal for football sort of has like the opposite effect that it had for basketball. Well, not for the transfer that basketball had with the one and done, where sort of in basketball, the one and done rule sort of made it where your goal was to really just get to the NBA immediately. Because if you wanted to get paid, you wanted to get to your second contract.
Yep, yep.
And with college football, it was like, hey, if you want to get paid, you need to make it to the NFL. So, like, as an underclassman, once you got your report back saying, oh, you're a third round talent, just go. But now with the transfer portal and NIL, guys can just stay.
Yeah.
And make their money.
And I think that some of it, like, is a fixed, like, it almost trickles into high school. Like, if, like Power Five schools, they used to have a certain number of scholarships that they would offer to high school students. Now, each of them are probably offering 7 to 8 less scholarships because they're just looking at the portal. And then, so, like, those 7 to 8
Because you adapt to level out.
We'll go to like a school like Tulsa or, you know, like that level. And then who normally would have got a Texas Tech offer, and then they'll play there for 2 years and then they'll like transfer from those schools. It's just, it's turned into a farm system is what we have.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's almost, I would say this, I think in 10 years, we're probably going to see the programs doing the best with college football will probably be the guys who have like the most former people used to work in the NFL. That's sort of what it is. It's almost like you got to scout and get your free agents and just put a team together just for that season.
Yeah.
And you just got to roll with it.
And it'll make people retire early. Like Mike Gundy will probably retire early. Like what he is like phenomenal at is identifying overlooked players, developing them into like star players. But, like, if you do that, if you spend 3 years, like, recruiting a guy in high school, and then by the time they're going to their junior year, they're ready to be a star, but they transfer to Ohio State, like, it could be soul-crushing. Like, you put all this time into this kid and, like, helped him get better, and then he leaves after – once he's ready to go to a blue blood, he goes. That would really start to grind you down. And, like, Nick Saban is one of the reasons he retired now, I think. Is because of that, and he doesn't have to deal with that to the level of like a TCU or whatever at Bama. But like even he got tired of it.
Yeah, he's Bama. The kids are gonna come there, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Elizabeth, what's going on?
Hey, Babak. I just wanted to say that a lot of people have told me that college football has changed forever and it's never going to be the same. It's bad. It's horrible. And I kind of disagree with that because I think what's happening with the NIL, I think there's going to be adjustments and we're going to adapt and things are going to level out. I think we're going to be fine.
I'm an optimist. I think it'll work out. I think it'll be whatever differences there are, we're going to not notice them because each year, we'll get someone who'll say, like, you know, I think one of the most popular posts on RCFB this past week is just the classic, like, oh, college football stinks. The players are all leaving, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I get, like, it can be frustrating at times, but then you see the audience continue to grow. And I mean, there's ways you could certainly kill the golden goose. And there's a debate about whether, you know, what will be the next thing that I'll do it. Will there be greed that does it? I'm not sure. But I think, at least for now, as long as a product on the field is entertaining, I think people are still going to watch. I think it's certainly giving us more stuff to talk about year round. I mean, this used to be like the deadest time in college football, and there's still constantly stories to talk about. The portal's opened up. I have to say, though, people have noticed while there were more people in the portal this year, it was not quite as crazy as people thought. I think the better argument for what's going on with the portal this year is we're starting to see it kind of mature out in the sense that
exactly
people are jumping in who are like, I want to test the waters, but it's less of a, we're not seeing like the chaos factor isn't there. The numbers have increased, but the chaos isn't there. We're not seeing like shocking star. I mean, there are a handful, like one or two people where you're like, oh man, like we just talked about, obviously, you know, like saying that you want to go to a proven winner and then going to Colorado is kind of a bit of a surprise with Dan Haynes, but he set that one up himself. There's always going to be an audience for offensive linemen. There's always going to be an audience for defensive tackles. So some of those guys hopping out there probably going to get some money. I mean, there are a couple of surprises there. I mean, obviously TCU losing Dominic Williams was kind of a surprise there, but he's going to get a huge payday because a proven starter who can jump aboard a team. There's a lot of teams looking for him. I mean, Texas would be more than happy to have him.
True.
And then the unfortunate situation with Washington and Wazoo. So it's not surprising that Damian Martinez from Oregon State wants to look somewhere, and he's a big hot. Actually, it's really interesting for the running backs because they've kind of obviously the NFL has cooled to running backs quite a bit in terms of what they're willing to pay. So if you're a college running back, man, get that payday.
Especially, like, remember when college kids transferred, they had to sit out a year, but yes, coaches could quit and leave and start the next day. I think that's a positive that they don't have to sit for a year and waste their talent on the sideline.
Yeah absolutely.
I do think one that maybe I'm wrong, just a hot take or thought. The reason why, like, maybe like the stars are this year starting to transfer less than they have before is because every university is like for the past few years was panicking to find their donor. They're rich, like they're big boosters, and they're like, we got to find them, we got to secure them. And then now they've all kind of got their donors, and they're all like, we got to, you know, everyone is, you know, starting to pay their players a lot of money now. And that maybe that,
and they're also realizing how much to pay. I think that was the thing too. The first couple of years, no one knew what to pay. That was the one thing I do like about one of Charlie Baker's proposals the NCAA had, although I don't know if it'll go through, the idea of making like these contracts public knowledge. Cause then a couple of things could happen. Players will know what they should expect or could expect. And then the universities would know how much to pay. And of course, could argue that it might depress the payments a little bit, but it would definitely take some of the because a lot of these guys are all operating in a mystery. You know, you don't know how much the other guy on your team might be getting. And that, I think, has been an interesting factor in all of it. Ski Mask, I see your hand up.
Yeah, this is a little bit shift of topic, but I wanted to answer to a question that you said on your podcast to see if I guess correctly.
Oh, on the college football, the college football survivor show.
Yeah, you had said a guy from your high school would have benefited from the transfer portal.
Yes, yes.
And I mentally, because I don't know your age, I was just placing it, and I mentally was like, no, because I just guessed you're from Cali.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, and my choice is like, either he went to the quarterback room and that was like a madhouse.
Yeah, and if you figured it out, please don't name him. I feel really bad if I name the guy.
No. I have no idea who the guy is, but I just thought I was like,
well, here, let me give everyone an update on this, because this is also why I believe in the transfer portal a lot. Only because I was the guy who, I was not a star athlete or anything in college at all. I was high school, I was a theater guy, right? But the guy on my high school football team who was the guy who got the FBS scholarship, he was the quarterback. He goes onto a team and he was considered, I mean, I remember he was perfect size. He was like, I'm almost 6'1". He was like 6'4", you know, good height, good arm, you know, good physique. And then I remember when I got really into football, especially when I got to college and went to USC, I'm like, wow, this is actually a great sport. Too bad I can't like just try out for the team here. Right. I noticed he kind of disappeared. Remember the old days, the quarterback would kind of disappear and end up as a tight end, and that's when you knew they'd been kind of put up to pasture. So that's where he ended up. And then as it turns out, long story short, I actually got to know one of his teammates who played in the NFL, and he told me like, oh yeah, your man, he got in the doghouse of the head coach, and so they let the other kid from my hometown start. That other kid's name, David Carr. If you know anything about the NFL in that era, he did not look back. Two kids from Bakersfield. David Carr was the other kid. And so if the NIL and the transfer portal existed now, he might not get a payday, but he would have ended up at another school, and no one would have blamed him for that.
And that's when I said one of my choices. So I was like, in my head, I was like, he's either talking about David Carr or Carson Palmer. And that's when I looked at Com, and I said, either he went into a quarterback room that was a madhouse, because there was like, what, two Heismans in that quarterback room? Then the one guy who didn't get a Heisman still ended up in the NFL. And then I was like, the other team, they ended up with a surprise and talent because David Carr just took off at Fresno State.
Exactly. He played for, I think it was Stockdale High School where I grew up.
it's just very unfortunate because I guess with the transport, I think a lot of people don't know like how much control like the university and head coach like had over your life as an athlete, because your letter of intent is a 1-year contract. So if the coach does not want you next year, he can just at the end of the calendar athletic year, like in July, he can just say, well, we're not giving you a scholarship. So then you just asked out. Then also, if you wanted to transfer, either you had to go down to at least Division II, or if you wanted to go Division I, your coach still had to sign off on you transferring. And so, like a lot of people who may know, like almost no school would allow you to transfer in conference. So it's like if you wanted to go to another school, that was probably out of pocket in your area.
And SEC is still like that. You can't if you're an SEC school, you can't portal to another SEC school. And I'm waiting. I don't know if that can even be challenged because it's its own thing. So you could theoretically go to any other conference, and it's not necessarily totally controlling competition in a monopolistic fashion. But that's an interesting one too. So anytime you see an SEC player drop in the portal, you can guarantee they can't go to another SEC school under the current rules.
That's kind of wild. Like, I do, like, randomly, I do think that Derek Carr kind of got dealt a terrible hand in the NFL, because he got thrown in to the Houston Texans with nothing. Like, that team was, like, one of the worst teams because they didn't really help the expansion teams. So he might have been a great NFL quarterback.
That was his brother. That was actually his younger brother. David's the...
Okay. But, and one thing I'd say about the transfer or like the NIL thing that I think has changed, and maybe all the people that maybe may know more than me can correct me. I think it's changed from the initial thing that it was like 4 or 5 years ago or however long, where everyone was kind of focused on high school kids. Like, we're going to pay the high school kids. We're going to find the best recruits. You're going to pay for the best recruits. And now NIL has changed to who is really good on a team that we can outpay. And that's kind of what it's turned into. Like, hey, if Pitt has a guy that we could maybe get more money to, we'll do that. Because that's a proven player. And I think the people, like, that were giving big money for high school kids have gotten burned a lot because their 4-star or 5-star kid doesn't always turn out. But if you look at a guy that's just finished his sophomore year in college and had 2 great years, you know he's good. And so I think the NIL has turned from, like, focusing their money on high school people to transfer portal people. And that's just a thought.
I agree with you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. I need someone to say something.
Yeah. No, I was on mute by accident. That's on me. Sometimes I always forget which button I've actually pressed. Hey, John, you've been super patient. What's on your mind?
Hey, man, how you been?
Good.
Eugene.
Yeah, it's nice to be back, man. I haven't been back in a couple weeks, so I figure I come back with the hard-hitting questions.
You jinx.
And my big heart, my hard-hitting question for tonight is, am I the only one who thinks that Jim Harbaugh's tattoo sucks?
No, it's so really, Jim Harbaugh.
I was expecting a much cooler tattoo, and the man looks like he got a prison tat. I don't know.
Okay,
We talked about it earlier.
Shocked by it because I asked the question right in the post game conference after the national title game, because somebody tipped me off that he promised the team he would get a. He would get a tattoo if they went 15-0. And he described exactly that. He's like, I'm going to get a block M over 15-0. And if you've ever seen the hats he wears when he was at Michigan head coach, it's weird to talk about in the past tense. He loves that really old like it's not what people think of when they think of the Michigan M, but I guess it's still a secondary logo. That really plain Jane kind of like not, it's definitely not bold font. It's like, I guess if you take control B on the Michigan logo, you get that. it goes back to the regular size font, and that's what he went with. I agree. It's a little underwhelming, but it is, as a guy who, as he would say, like, I got no ink. But it fits what he's doing, man. He's living on an RV by the beach. You know, he's kind of like living the life. It kind of fits. Certainly for him.
Living in a van down by the river, you know?
Yeah, except it's an RV on the beach, and it probably is nicer than a van.
And his best friend's Justin Herbert, and he's about to draft Marvin Harrison Jr. Like, he's got it made.
Yeah, it's such a, I mean, you know, at least you could say it's true to form, right? Oh, by the way, I'm sorry, Mage Ingrid, your hand's been up, and then we'll get to level up Luke.
Oh, I just remembered. So the Aflac kickoff here in Atlanta in a few months is Clemson versus Georgia. So I'm like, oh wow, because they ain't played each other in the bed, haven't they?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I don't know the lot. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I just hope it's a good game, actually.
Yeah, well, it'll be really interesting to see where Georgia leaves off and how strong Clemson's going to be. I mean, I wouldn't expect Clemson necessarily win that one, but I would, if Clemson can keep it competitive. I mean, because again, the wonderful thing is about the 12-team playoff, you can drop a game, maybe even two games, and still theoretically get in. I mean, if you just win your conference, you're in. I mean, as I've said before, a lot of casual fans are going to get surprised when we get to the actual playoff layout, because the top four seeds have to go to the top four conference champs, which are presumably, unless something really goes off the rails, it's going to be the remaining P4 teams. By the way, side note, for those who haven't paid attention, the NCAA has now officially reclassified the Pac-12 as basically a G5 program, a G5 conference, which was not a shocker. I believe they're now called, they're no longer an autonomous conference.
They're now
they are non-autonomous.
That's what they're called.
Oh my god! They're no, they're money. They got to walk
with a lot of money.
That's fantastic.
What the heck?
We can't call them broke because they're in control of all the money they made.
Yeah, they did walk away with a lot of money, but yeah, no, I mean, my favorite response in the post about it is a Boise State fan writing, "Cougs, Beavs, welcome." oh man, it's tough for them. Oh man. But hey, I just want to say, hey, level up Luke. You've been patient. What's on your mind?
Hey, yeah, I just had to charge my phone a little bit before I could jump in here. But what's up, everybody? What's up, Ski Mask? Yeah, so I actually watched the Syracuse spring game, and the Syracuse fan base has been pretty hyped up with Fran Brown coming from Georgia, bringing in the best recruiting class and transfer class in school history that I'm aware of in the modern era. And yeah, the commentators on the spring game kept saying, you know, this is a playoff caliber team over and over again. You got, you know, the Ohio State quarterback making NFL level throws. We have the number one receiver is probably an NFL first rounder who was injured all of last season back in Aronde Gadsden. And just the beef, they look like a mid-tier SEC or Big Ten team in terms of size. And I look at the schedule. This is probably the weakest schedule that Syracuse has had in 10 years. And there's no Clemson. There's no Florida State. The toughest team on the schedule might be NC State. I'm having a really hard time putting the floor below 8 or 9 wins.
Yeah, this is a remarkable schedule you're bringing up here, because I was just looking at it as you were talking about that. So for those who aren't aware, first of all, you guys start with 4 home games, which is really nice. I mean, Ohio, so again, that's very winnable. Georgia Tech, which, again, I don't know is going to be as strong as it's going to be. You have a classic ACC matchup with Stanford coming to Syracuse.
Ivy League Bowl.
I have to get over the fact that it's no longer called a Carrier Dome. So, pardon me, the JMA Wireless Dome, because they could finally do work on it. For those, I don't want to get sidetracked by that, but the whole story about the Carrier Dome name was fascinating to me because it was a weird thing to break up. Holy Cross, winnable at UNLV. Boy, that's a sweet one because of Allegiant. I love it. Ever since they moved to Allegiant, who doesn't want to play UNLV now? Like, I want to go play at UNLV.
I'm psyched, man. That's a road trip. I want to go.
Yeah, go. Go.
Yeah, it was in Las Vegas last week. That was pretty.
Yeah, that's going to be an amazing like experience. NC State, I agree. That's the strongest of these teams. Can you get Pitt, Virginia Tech? Okay, and then the final game, but I'll go through it. At Boston College, at Cal, because again, we're in the ACC now. UConn, and then Miami. Miami is the mystery because they've got, okay, like what we're seeing with the talent. I mean, for example, even some of like Damian Martinez looks like he might end up there. I mean, even with the talent they got now, there's like it could flop. It is Miami. They're very unpredictable. Maybe they'll accidentally botch a game like they did against Georgia Tech. But the talent level there and with Cam Ward and those receivers is pretty phenomenal. But all of that said, only to say those are, in my mind, yeah, those are the two tough games, playing at NC State. And luckily, Miami goes up to Syracuse. So that is a weak
schedule. That is a, like, no offense to Syracuse. You play with your friend. That's an embarrassingly weak schedule for a Power 5. A question, like growing up, like I grew up in the mid to late 90s, early 2000s, like Oklahoma State was a basketball school, and Eddie Sutton retired, we've just fell off, and then Mike Denny came around the same time, we've gotten good at football. And when we stole or took Western Kentucky's basketball coach this year, I seen a Western Kentucky guy being like, see how much he enjoys it at a football school. And that like blew my mind because I was like, I realized like, we're a football school now, like, which is wild. We never were. And then I had a thought, like, do all basketball schools, are they just basketball schools until they're good at football? Like, because I think if Kansas
That's a great question. So, like, Kentucky is like a basketball school, right? And even in football, when they're good, it's still a basketball school. Duke, you know, when their football team is good, they're still a basketball school. Syracuse is weird because they have a historic basketball program. They're considered a basketball blue blood, but oddly enough, in Central New York, I think people get up more for football. Yeah. It's always been like football is the heart of the program and or the heart of the athletic department, but they were just bad for so long. Like
I agree, but see, I'm old enough to remember, like
pretty much
Donovan McNabb.
But before he became the Chunky Soup spokesman, I remember Donovan McNabb at Syracuse. That was right when I was getting into football. And even the Chunky Soup thing might be too old of a reference at this point.
No, I get that completely. And I grew up watching Donovan at the Dome and Dwight Freeney and Marvin Harrison. That was like my childhood growing up. But then they were good in the 80s.
Marvin Harrison went to Syracuse.
Yeah, right around the same time as Donovan McNabb. We have obviously
a squad.
Heisman Trophy winner in Jim Brown, the greatest ever. First black Heisman winner. Ernie Davis. Ernie Davis was the first Heisman winner. Jim Brown was before him and would have won the Heisman if it wasn't for, obviously, Southern Heisman voters. Then they both were drafted by the Cleveland Browns, and Ernie Davis died before he could play in the NFL.
Yeah.
But
Justin Blackman,
yeah, Larry Zonka.
If it wasn't for y'all's Northeastern bias, no.
People don't realize how big of a deal Syracuse program. Football has been historically. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think Syracuse's history kind of doesn't let them be a basketball school trope. While Kansas, Duke, Kentucky are kind of their own sort of like, no, we're back. I mean, Kansas has got its own whole reason to be like, you know, we helped invent the sport kind of thing going on there. But, obviously the guy who invented the sport went there, to, you know, and settled down there. But
like Indiana, I'm sure.
He went there to get high and go to bed.
Exactly. Indiana. Yeah, you got to mention Indiana in there. UCLA to an extent, although UCLA, I think John Wooden single-handedly did that. I mean, you don't win, 11 of 12 national championships in a row. You know, you don't do that and not turn your school into a bit of a basketball school. But
Oklahoma State's the first school to win back-to-back natties. Henry Iva. We're the first school to win it. 45-46.
Love it.
We have two national titles, 7 Final Fours, but we've won 3 NCAA tournament games since 2006. So. Sad time.
I want to rotate through some of the folks who've had their hands up. John, what's on your mind?
Hey, a little off subject from what we just talked about, and it might have been discussed already earlier in the call, but what is your thoughts about the state of Virginia, where proud Virginia here, about passing the law allowing schools to directly pay players?
I think it's a step in where the direction it should go at this point. Well, but I mean, there's two things going on there. I think that's the direction a lot of universities would like to go now that everyone's used to NIL. Because at first, remember, it was very much arms length distance between the universities and the NILs, mostly because of the way the laws were designed.
What happened?
As we started to watch last offseason, it started to erode quite a bit as schools, because as I said before, it's a very easy political basket. You can get bipartisan support at a state level. Hey, let's support the big public universities and their athletic departments. Let's let them do this. Like, there isn't real controversy. Everyone loves those bills because, you know, you get both sides of the aisle to come together and pass these laws very easily, a lot of times unanimously. And we started to see this race to loosen up the rules. I remember Missouri, you know, jumping ahead last offseason, allowing deals to be made, and they designed it so well. A high schooler in the state of Missouri could get start getting some of an NIL deal so long as they committed to a football program, or I should say a sports program in the state of Missouri. So it was basically the Mizzou football law, which again had paid off well for them. And now a lot of state, but going back the second half of this Virginia law, which is the next step in this evolution, this is why, and I always tell people now, especially I came to this conclusion, and a lot of people have come to it earlier, that were really like lawyers and economists that had their fingers on the pulse, on this. We are absolutely inevitably going to be paying players as employees. It's coming. I mean, this Virginia law is like the next logical step. So, okay, the schools can do NIL deals. We're going to be.
Can you explain law?
John, do you know it a little better than I do? I mean, I have it in front. I know how to the 10,000 foot thing, but do you know why don't you explain the nuance of it?
Yes, I can explain it pretty basically. Essentially, it allows schools to, you know, historically they would have to go for a booster or some or a business to essentially get an NIL deal to a player. This new law essentially allows universities themselves to directly get NIL sponsorships to the players directly
from the school.
From the school. Yes, the direct has been response has been pretty quick. I can say as an Old Dominion fan, Old Dominion or ODU already announced that they were going to go with the status quo and not take advantage of the bill at this time or the new law. But and that is because the Sun Belt has instructed both Old Dominion and James Madison to essentially follow the NCAA rules to stay on the even playing field with the rest of the Sun Belt.
Because they'd be afraid of creating that level of unfair. But the thing is, then I guarantee you, we're going to see other legislatures add this, and it's going to eventually. I don't know. Metastasize makes it sound very negative, but it's gonna grow to all the other states at some point or another. But the reason it's important is this is going to get a giant. We're waiting for the day. I mean, we have all these kind of parallel tracks. We have lawsuits that are going on with the House case, the NCAA House case, which is for basically NIL back pay for players that didn't qualify because the NIL rule was added later. You have all of these other lawsuits. You have the NLRB challenges for unionization efforts going on. Obviously, the Dartmouth case is pending review. You have one file that you see at USC and the private schools in California. You have one that was just filed with NLRB case against Notre Dame. But you're eventually going to get a judge in one of these cases or even another case and just say, why are you guys pretending like these guys aren't employees? Like, courts hate really weird hoops, fictitious things to try and basically hide from what is the reality of a situation. And their only hope for stopping it is getting Congress to kind of carve out an exception like they did for baseball and the monopoly and all of that stuff. And it's just not going to happen.
And I get this, and that's where we're headed, but I think every fan of a Big 12 and ACC team should be hope this doesn't happen. Because if you look at the TV deals and the amount of money differential between the ACC, Big 12, and then the SEC and the Big 10, if this happens, the ACC and the Big 12 are no longer like viable because they cannot compete in the money because they are now they're making so much less than the Big 10 and the SEC. So if this law passes, then like Mississippi State will have $40 million every year. So over 3 years, $120 million more to spend than Oklahoma State. And so selfishly, I hope this doesn't happen, because that will kill a lot of and that's why I think they're going to have to absorb a lot of other teams if this does happen. But, like, that will kill the ACC and the Big 12 and every other.
Well, one parallel track I will say is some of these lawsuits could very well just smash the NCAA, and it could turn into a couple of things. The NCAA doesn't enforce any rules anymore, and it's up to the conferences to come up with their own, or it shatters it, and they have to basically rebuild the way the conferences are built. And that's why that Super League that was talked about, you know, in the last couple of weeks, it was never going to go anywhere because it had no buy-in. But the thing where it had some value is if a situation, a doomsday scenario comes up where, you know, for example, one of these cases could not only attack the NCAA, but the conferences to pay the back pay. If they decide, okay, well, why don't we just destroy the conferences to save the universities and reconstitute something from scratch? The theories and some of the ideas in the Super League might come back there, not as that, but as some, you know, starting point. It could not be that way. I just want to throw that out there as another possibility, where if things do totally blow up, then you might see a situation where they're like, okay, well, let's reconstitute everything and decide which team. You know, this is a good, like, segue to just at least acknowledge the fact that there was this kind of reporting going on. I know someone asked it in the comments. The Group of Five leaders supposedly are discussing a G5 only playoff. We've heard that before. I know NIU's athletic director's hot on that. There's some theories out there that, in the kind of the concern that they're seeing of what's going on with the SEC and Big Ten, kind of having their joint planning partnership, or however they're calling it, not an alliance. No one wants to call anything an alliance anymore. But that perhaps the G5 conferences might create either a G5 only postseason, or at maybe a realignment that creates a super conference of G5 teams. And then, you know, the private equity thing is popping up here. Apparently, former head coach Derek Dooley is like a salesman for one of these private equity firms that is making contact with the schools. So far, not a whole lot it seems to be going anywhere yet. But this is percolating in the background, because we've heard of the idea of like a G5, a Group of Five playoff. I always thought it was kind of a weird thing to do, only because it just seems to take a little bit of buzz. Maybe unless you're saying, like, if whichever G5 teams that didn't make the big playoff, then maybe you're creating what feels like, you know, an NIT-ish kind of a tournament, but with only the G5 programs. But, you know, that's an interesting thing to throw out there, only because it's been floating in the background as well. John, I know you're probably chomping at the bit here for this.
Yeah, I did want to say one last thing. I believe Virginia probably jumped on this too, because we have definitely, ever since the transfer portal has come out, we've, you know, brought in our riches, but the riches quickly leave the house as well. I know, not even old, not only just Old Dominion, but James Madison has, you know, gets, especially after this year, got completely raided. Virginia Tech's been getting rated for almost all sports, UVA as well too, to an extent. So it's I think it's come to the point that Virginia's trying to, you know get a little ahead of the curves and trying to, you know, grab a little bit more viability to its own programs by, you know, trying to offer this advantage. And also one quick thing, I know I spoke about it earlier, but I had to put one last point to this. Jim Harbaugh's tattoo looks like an ass tat. That's the last thing I'm going to say about
it. It's a man tat, brother. And Virginia just wants to – they are, like, positioning themselves the best that they can to get that Big Ten invite. They are a high academic prestige. They know the ACC is dying. They know it. And they can't say it because they're all, like – I mean, they brought an SMU. Are you kidding? Like, if you're bringing in SMU, then, you know, it's the writing's on the wall. Maybe it'd be 5 years, maybe it's three, maybe it's 10. But, like, the Virginia is, like, playing the long play of, like, we want to get into the Big Ten. In my opinion.
Yeah, and I think, it's as it's been said, I think Virginia and UNC are the two schools that have been staying mostly quiet, but know that they're going to have a bit of a fight for their by the SEC, especially UNC, because that was kind of the comment. Like, Clemson and Florida State for sure, Miami would get some interest, maybe even Georgia Tech because of, you know, academic fit. They're certainly respectable academic university, but yeah, no, UVA comes up because, yeah, they are a prestigious state university and all of that. You know, Ski Mask Murphy, What's on your mind? I'm going to slowly start wrapping this up because we're now clocking in at an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, because I was going to bring up when my hand was raised the comment that everything Texas State brought up with Heather Dinich with the whole group of five playoff thing, which it coming from her lets you know there's some legitimate people saying this because she's basically Miss College Football Playoff. Like, whatever goes on in those rooms, she's the only one who knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing is just sort of like, especially with the Super League thing happening as well. Sorry, getting a little clogged up. But it seems like the top teams want to, like, almost try to separate themselves from the rest of everyone else too much.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that I think it could be to their detriment. But if they push it too far, like, I just see, like, the group of five, maybe some of the lower teams in the Power Five, just say, hey, let's just join up with the FCS program, FCS programs, and create a whole new system. Just let those guys do their own thing. And then they might
be the minor league. Money.
Yeah. There's no money in minor leagues. Like they want to, even if they suck at the bottom, they'd rather, like, money wise, I'm saying fan opinion or anything like that, but like in strictly money based, the people that make those decisions would rather be the Vanderbilt of the SEC than the South Dakota State of Division II.
I do agree the money is the biggest factor here, because even the schools that would still want to, that would be at the detriment, will still want to hang on. I mean, and I don't want to pick on them, but that's why Akron is hanging on to still be in the MAC, even though they moved up in, what, 93 from FCS, and they've never really had any success. But, I mean, the money is so much better there than you know, going back to an FCS conference.
Yeah, but I just think it's just going to come to a head where the top group are trying to just squeeze so much money out and leave everybody else behind that everybody else will just say, okay, forget it. We're not going to play this, especially now in this NIL transporter era. They were like, we're not going to play this weird sort of are they or aren't they employees game. We're just going to go, hey, this is our version of college football that just meets the minimum means of what we can actually afford. You guys go off and try to make your own little pro league that can't really compete with the actual pro league, and then might just let them be in that sort of weird gray area for the top schools that they either push themselves beyond the NFL or just flounder, which my money would be on floundering because competing with the NFL is crazy. They stole the day of the week that used to belong to the church. So,
well, they may be
pushing too far.
The NFL can take what they want, like in terms of like numbers and ratings. Like the NBA like used to own Christmas, and then the NFL was like, "Why are we doing this?" And then they just took it, and now it's theirs.
Yeah,
and they can do that.
I'm old enough to remember when Thursday was a college football day.
Oh,
only.
Yeah, dude.
That's
an 07.
Until late. I remember Thursday night football did not occur until Thanksgiving. Then they played like 4 weeks of it. Then that was it. Now it's like literally the first game of the season is on Thursday in the NFL.
Last thing, it's insane. Last thing I'll say, I'm gonna hop up here, and thanks for letting me chat up with you guys. But I disagree with that. Like going back to like 2003 to like 2010, 13, like Thursday was the college football day. Like the college, and they would like USC would get beat every time they threw their ass on Thursday. Like back when Matt Leinart, like that was when USC would get upset. Like, cause USC would lose on random days. Like Friday.
It would always be like a Friday or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate a Friday night names. Like that cost us a national title. But and that also got everybody a playoff system. So, the college football owned Thursdays. Like it was a big deal. Like college football Thursday night was like on ESPN, like the main channel. Like it was a big deal. And then NFL was like, no, we're gonna start doing one on Thanksgiving from then on. And then so after Thanksgiving it was NFL's day. But then the NFL was like, well, let's just start doing it before Thanksgiving. So then the NFL just took up the whole Thursday thing. And they could do that with any day. And that's why, like, you know, you couldn't compete with the NFL. And that's why I'm kind of nervous about the Big 12 trying to do something with, like, a Big 12 game of the night on Thursdays. Like, I don't – like, they just get smashed in the ratings. But, yeah. It's just NFL can take what they want, man. They could do what they want. Yeah. They own the college. Like the second most popular sport in America is college football. It goes NFL, yep. College football, like NBA.
Well, NBA is still pretty popular. I don't know.
NBA is up there.
I don't know. Like the college football national championship will outdraw every like that.
Well, yeah, I think the game by game, I think college football will have some bigger games, but I think overall the NBA does have a bigger draw. But I'm going to slowly start wrapping this up just because, again, I got to eventually get to bed myself. I've been going on for about an hour and 45 minutes.
Thanks, guys. I'm out.
So typically in off season, we try to do it for about an hour. I just want to thank all of you guys for joining us, men and women. It's great to hear from you. Always hear your thoughts on what's going on. This was RCFB Talk 190. My name is Bob Akhayeri. It's always great talking to all of you. And let's see, this will automatically turn into a recording. And I just realized I totally misspelled CFB in the title here. I'm going to fix that. There we go. Done. There we go. So that's what happens when you do it in a hurry, right? Yeah, exactly. And let's see here. So again, the draft's coming up. We'll probably talk about how that went. We've got a reporter who's down there, so we'll be tweeting about that. He'll be the one tweeting about it. So again, college football. I'm a part of the College Football Survivor Show, which is done by Advanced Media Group. They're the newspaper group that owns Oregonian, Cleveland.com, AL.com, anything live at the end of it, like Penn Live, M Live. I do that with CBS Sports, Shahan Jayaraja. We'll hopefully do a show this week. He's been super busy, so we're actually putting it off this week. And not like anything's going on right now. Can't wait to figure out what's going on in the portal, too. It's so wild. The portal and has absolutely kept college football exciting and interesting. Maybe not fun, but certainly interesting. And, you know, it's like that supposed Chinese proverb that it's a curse. May you live in interesting times. Well, we are in interesting times week after week here in college football. But on that note, thank you all for listening. Now I'm going to hang up and listen.